What happens when wind turbines meet wheat fields? Across Western Australia, more and more farmers are being approached by energy companies with big ideas and big infrastructure. But what does it all mean for your farm? This limited series from Farm & Co dives into diversifying farm income, integrating renewable energy into agriculture, a project sparked by growers just like you looking for clarity, opportunity and a fair deal. Over three episodes, the series unpacks the findings of a grower survey and explores what's really driving renewable energy interest in WA's ag sector, from the financial upside and long-term business resilience to the social, legal and environmental realities on the ground. Whether you're curious, cautious or already in talk, this series is your independent guide to navigating the renewables rollout. Welcome to episode one of Farm & Co's three-part series on diversifying farm income through renewable energy. I'm your host, Shannon Beattie, and in this episode, we're setting the scene. As conversations about renewable energy ramp up across the regions, many WA farmers are finding themselves at the centre of a major transition. Energy companies are knocking on doors, looking on lease land for wind and solar developments. But for growers, these approaches often come with more questions than answers. In this first episode, we're taking a closer look at why these projects are gaining momentum, what's attracting interest from both developers and landholders, and how some farmers are starting to navigate the opportunities and the challenges. To help us get started, I'm joined by Farm & Co project manager Kelly Ryan and grower Mark Fowler, who has firsthand experience navigating this new and sometimes complex landscape. Kelly, Mark, welcome. Can you please start by introducing yourselves?
My name's Kelly Ryan and I'm the project manager at Farm & Co.
And what is your role as a project manager?
To oversee a lot of the project investments that Farm & Co has. We've got quite a diverse portfolio of activities. Obviously, this wind farms project is one of them. So just to oversee the projects.
And over to you, Mark. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your farming operation?
My name's Mark Fowler. We farm at Williams, Wickapen and Harrismith, plant about 8,000 hectares of crop, run some sheep that's declining fairly rapidly. We grow a fair bit of export oat and hay, canola, barley, oats, wheat. I'm also the president of the WA Farmers Grains Council.
Beautiful. Kelly, let's start off with a bit of an intro to the project. Can you give us an overview of what this is all about?
Yeah, absolutely, Shannon. So this project came about quite organically. We had, over the past 2 to 3 years, a growing number of Farm & Co clients reaching out after being approached by wind farm or renewable energy companies. And they really wanted to understand who the proponents were, what the long-term implications might be for their farm business, and whether or not the deals on offer were fair and beneficial. So as we started digging into it, we realised this isn't just a one-off situation, it's likely to be a trend worth digging into. So that's what led us to this desktop study in partnership with the South West Drought and Innovation Hub, with the aim to get a clear picture of how these renewable energy projects are playing out on ground and what they could mean for farming business in the long term.
Tell me how the study worked, Kelly. What did you guys actually do? Who did you talk to? What sort of information did you gather?
Yeah, for sure. So the project had effectively two parts. The initial part was to really try and pull in as much information as we can from the literature, but also talk to as many growers as possible. So the survey was very much the majority part of the project, and we surveyed up to 40 growers across the WA grain growing regions to understand their interest and experience in renewable energy. So the survey effectively asked growers two things: what their experience had been with renewable energy projects on farm and why they chose to be involved. And for those with infrastructure systems, we asked, you know, the details of what's on their land, how it came about, and whether or not they feel fairly compensated and how it's impacting their overall operations. And we also explored what influenced their decision making. So was it financial, environmental, or more personal? And for those that didn't have projects, we tried to tease out the decision-making behind that.
Mark, I feel like we now just need to throw over to you to answer all of those questions that Kelly just had that were in that survey.
Oh, sorry, Mark.
So let's go with it to begin with. I'm assuming you're based on this that you do have a renewable energy project on your farm. Can you tell us what that project is and when it started?
We were approached by a wind farm proponent a few years ago, and they were interested in opening a conversation with us, installing some wind monitoring equipment and beginning what has been a long conversation about how we might do this. And what followed from that was some planning about what it might look like on the ground, a site visit to some other wind farms to see what it looks like in reality, what it sounds like, what it feels like. And then that necessarily led to a conversation about the potential commercial terms that might apply, what we might be paid, how they might interact with our farming business, and then a very long process of negotiating and ultimately signing landholder agreements, which in our case took around 34 drafts and about 2 years of backwards and forwards conversations, exchanging drafts, meetings. It's normal in this space for the wind farm proponent to cover the reasonable legal costs of the landholders. So we knew the firm that they were using. We needed to make sure that we had a firm of a similar ilk to represent them. We formed a syndicate between most of the landholders in our group, and that enabled a common discussion and for it to be much more efficient than it otherwise would be. It would be a little bit like herding cats otherwise. And yeah, so now we're at the stage where we have a landholder agreement signed in each case. I think there's still one or two growers still to go, but yes, there's certainly enough for the project to proceed, and they're moving to the next stage of engaging the community.
It sounds like it was a pretty drawn out process, Mark. How did you find it overall? Was it time consuming? Did it not really matter so much because you had those lawyers involved? How did the actual process feel for you?
Probably a bit different to me than some of the other members in the group, because I led the process because of my history. I was a commercial or a corporate lawyer in a previous life, and I did work a bit in this space. And I was certainly very familiar with project finance deals and even did a couple of offshore wind farms when I worked in the UK. So it was a lot of work for me. And lawyers, if people have the impression that lawyers will do the work for you, it just doesn't work like that. Lawyers need instructions. They can't do anything without instructions. So our documents are probably 180 pages or so in length, a lot of detail. But I think it was really important we really got ourselves involved in the detail, because there's a lot of these agreements are going to last 32 plus years. So the legacy is going to be long, so they have to be done right, and that's the view that we adopted. I will say that the wind farm companies were our proponent was very patient. When I said we had harvest, we had hay, everything just stopped and had to. And so they had to kind of work around our program, and they did pretty well. All of that said, time is of the essence. There's a lot of wind farm projects out there that want to get done, way more than the state needs, and being organized at the front end is you get a project priority, and it's all about transmission capacity. So getting a link to the Western Power network. So it was important that we got it done as quickly as we could, but necessarily there's a lot of detail. As I said, it's going to last for a long time. And I think in our case, the wind farm company was good at understanding where we were coming from and accommodating much of what we asked for. It's important to realise, and I'm sure farmers realise this, but farmers absolutely hold the whip hand here. No one can require you to do anything in this space. So when we initially got a fairly adverse set of terms and conditions, we pretty much had to say, look, take it back and start again, because there's nothing here that persuades us to do a wind farm deal.
Kelly, when you did the lit review and did this survey and spoke with growers, what did you find the main concerns were from farmers? What were they worried about would happen if they took one of these projects on?
Yeah, that's a really good question, trying to understand what the barriers were for sure. So, I mean, we learned that, I guess, not all experiences were positive. Just like anything, a small few can ruin it for all. So we discovered like a lot of growers had issues with roads being damaged or gates being left open, or there wasn't that mutual understanding of how the farming operation works and accommodating that, which is what Mark just spoke about. So it was lovely to hear that was accommodated in his situation. But overall, you know, having a good line of communication with the proponents, sometimes that necessarily wasn't there, sometimes it was. So that, you know, that was great to hear that as well. You know, trust issues effectively drive what we all do in every aspect of our lives. So if the trust wasn't there and established, often that was one of the first barriers to looking at having wind farms or any other renewable energy projects on farm.
Kelly, on the flip side of that, what were the opportunities and the benefits that, growers were sort of hoping to explore? We obviously just discussed the things that they didn't potentially like, but what were the elements that made this potentially appealing for them?
Yeah, from the growers that we spoke to, most could see the value in having that diversified income on farm. They could see as an opportunity to reduce debt or support business growth. So there certainly was a lot of interest from growers to explore that diverse income to becoming on farm. So compensation definitely has been a big motivator. Yeah, we saw a great range of turbine payments ranging from like 40 grand to 80 grand per turbine per year. So yeah, obviously compensation was a big motivator, but understanding implications long-term on farm was information that growers were seeking.
Mark, when it came to your decision to be involved in a project, what were the main factors behind that decision? Was it purely financial? Were there other decisions at play?
There are probably a number of factors. We could see that a wind farm project could be something that would deliver a financial benefit without compromising the way in which we farm. We knew that there was a fair bit of interest in this area. And I think a lot of farmers have taken the view that if they don't participate in the wind farm project, they're probably still going to be looking at wind farm turbines in any event. And they'd rather be part of that process and part of that conversation and have a say in the, you know, the terms on which that occurs. And if you're in the tent, you've got a far better way of doing that. So I think most farmers, they all have reservations as to how this will play out. And that's why we spent so much time on the detail to try to have as much control over where the turbines go and the way in which the wind farm projects can interact with us and our farms. But I think it's attractive at a financial level to have another income source which can serve other purposes. It helps with succession arrangements. It helps with retirement arrangements. But ultimately, all the farms that we're talking about are successful farms enjoying pretty good times in agriculture. No one needed a wind farm project. And that was really important coming to the negotiation to save the wind farm company. No one here needs a wind farm project. We're quite happy if there isn't one. So therefore, if you want to do this project here, it'll be on these terms. And that definitely helped inform the discussion around that.
Just picking up on Mark mentioned, the experience of the neighbours that don't have wind farms or any other renewable energy on farm. So it was interesting to understand that their negotiating power was still there as well, as far as having, so if the turbine is near their boundary, you know, it obviously could affect how they operate. So it was interesting to discover that, yeah, the neighbouring properties do have that negotiation power as well, as far as doing setback clauses or compensation if they're impacted and not necessarily hosting the infrastructure themselves. So that was quite fascinating to discover.
It is very common for these wind farm projects to have landholder agreements with the neighbouring farms, whether that involves a payment just for their part in it and any inconvenience or cost that they feel they might be exposed to. But also it's also another common strategy of the wind farm companies to offer them some part of the project. It might be a turbine or two. There might need to be a power line go through their farm, which is paid for as well. Or it might be a substation, or, you know, it might be a battery. There's other ways for them to bring the neighbours into the conversation. And if that's on that part of their farm that's on the inside, then there can be quite a ring of farms that surrounds the project that's actively engaged with the project, so that you don't have so many or any of those landholder issues. There are some wind farms that are in really heavily populated places. That's really complicated. Turbines need to be at least 1,500 to 1,600 metres from a noise-sensitive premises, which includes a residence. Where our project is, there's not much of that. They're generally large-ish farms, so there's less of that issue.
Kelly, when you were undertaking the study on this and a literature review, did you get any statistics or information around expectations on how widespread this is going to become across the state over the next 5 or 10 years?
Yeah, what we did discover in the survey is the projects that are currently being discussed with the growers that are involved, the number of turbines varied hugely. It can be as anything from 2 to over 50 on a single property, but it's really not fixed until it's fixed, if you know what I mean. Like, that number can be negotiated and it can depend on what the proponent needs and the grower's situation is. So as far as providing an estimate of percentage land area, it's unclear at this point, as that number can change through the negotiations.
Mark, what has the impact for you been on farm? I understand you don't actually have a full wind farm operation up and running on the property yet, but what has the impact so far been of even people coming in and out of the property, them setting up that wind monitoring equipment? How has it impacted your operation?
It hasn't, other than the negotiations around the terms that might apply and the interface with the PR people, there hasn't been any interaction because they've done some ecological studies, but that's about all. So it's been very limited on the ground because we didn't have any wind monitoring equipment on our particular farm. They had 2 monitoring masts and they were at other neighbouring farms. So for us, there's been very limited physical interactions so far.
How are you anticipating that's going to work in the future? And is that something that's actually included as part of the contract in terms of how they interact with yourself and interact with your property?
100%. They have to give notice every time they come onto the farm. There's biosecurity requirements that apply with when they bring their vehicles onto the farm. There's fire. You know, they have to observe all of our fire specifications that we require, or the requirements that we require them to observe. And what they do when they're here, there are limitations in terms of the way in which they interact with our business during our busy times. There needs to be an ongoing conversation basically all the time about what happens on our farms. And we've been very clear about that. And it's very, very prescriptive in our agreements.
I'm assuming that something as simple as you mentioned earlier of, no, you're not coming onto the property to construct this in the middle of harvest, like that, you know, find another time of the year to do it effectively.
Well, it probably isn't that black and white. It'll be a case of working together, but they can't shut down roads. They can't prevent us from getting access to our farm or our roads because they're bringing stuff in. At the end of the day, when they go ahead with the project, they're offering to pay us quite a lot of money and they're buying something. It's not completely free from interference, and it's important people that understand that they are buying something. So it's not going to be like nothing's changed. There will have to be some collaboration and an agreement in the space, and it won't be like they're not there. There will be some interference.
Kelly, have you found those that are hesitant to be involved in a renewable energy project? Does that come down to not understanding it properly, not wanting to take on the risks involved, or simply actually just not wanting to have a renewable project on their farm?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, and the survey did tease that out a little bit. We discovered that some growers are just fundamentally opposed. They don't like the look of the turbines, or they don't want the infrastructure on their land. And others have had bad experiences, which I spoke to a little bit earlier, around the early negotiations. So sometimes those negotiations just fell through and that was the end of that. We did discover there was some grower resistance for renewable energies on farm.
When it comes to getting these projects on farm, do growers or farmers need to wait for the renewable company to approach them, or can it go the other way?
Look, it's definitely, that would be unusual. There are projects that have been done around the country where farmers have instigated their own wind farm projects, and Flat Rocks is an example of one of those. I think they had someone within the family that had a background in that, and there's an incredible amount of know-how and business contacts that are important to roll out a project like this. But I recall in the early days of our conversations, I spoke to a consultant in the East, an engineering firm that is open to running projects with farmers. And that would give people the expertise, the connections, maybe not locally, but to be able to roll out a project of your own. I don't think you'd go to an existing wind farm company and say, would you like to come and do a wind farm on my land? Doubtless they will have worked, they'll have their own business drivers, and they'll have worked out using modelling to work out where the best wind and the best project fundamentals might exist. By all means, to make a phone call, but you'd have to have, you're almost going to do it with a group of farmers and say, look, we've got 10 willing farmers willing to do this if you're interested. But generally speaking, if you really wanted to, you believed you had a wind resource that was worth developing and you didn't want to go wait for a wind farm company, you could speak to an engineering firm like that that does that, and they might come and do some modelling and work out whether you've got something that's worth doing, but you'd pay for that.
Kelly, when it comes to the survey that was done, did it just look into wind, or was solar something that you looked into as well?
Yeah, so with the survey, there were two main types of renewable energy projects that came up. The questions weren't specifically around wind farms, but that was definitely the majority that came through. So wind farms that fed power directly back into the Southwest Interconnected System, the SWIS, the WA's main electricity grid. And the second was wind power used to produce green hydrogen. We did have a solar case study. Yeah, it was only mentioned once in the survey, which was actually a bit surprising. I'd expect a little bit more of the solar opportunities there.
It is important for farmers to realise that there's a lots of growth. There are agreements out there that give the wind farm company the option to also develop a solar project as part of the project, and it's important that, you know, that if farmers are not up for that, that that gets specifically excluded. And we were really clear about that. A solar project should be on lower value land, not high value farming land, because it does tie up land in a much more serious way.
Yeah, I suppose there's not the ability to potentially still be using that paddock in the same way that there is with wind farms or wind turbines on a paddock. Mark, from your experience, is there anything that you would have done differently from the beginning, now ending up down the line, you know, 2 or 3 years later?
I suppose we would have tried to have done it more quickly. 2 years is a long time, and 34 drafts is a lot of documents to be involved with. But look, I think it really sort of played out pretty well. Given how important it is, it would have been, you know, it would be fantastic to travel a bit more around the country and see. Because the eastern states market is ahead of our own, it would have been instructive perhaps to have gone to the eastern states and seen what's happened with their energy market there and how wind farms have been rolled out there and what the experiences of people have been. But in general, it feels like so far the process has been quite good. Slow, but I think we've all been reasonably happy the way the process has gone so far.
Yeah, and that was something that we picked up in the survey as well. Like, despite the challenges, their overall tone was optimistic. It was cautionarily optimistic, but it was certainly optimistic. It's certainly an opportunity that's worth going in, eyes wide open, pull all the information that you can get to make that informed decision. So,
and to finish up, Mark, my final question for you, any tips for negotiating this both with the companies but also working with your fellow farmers? You've mentioned that there's a fair few landholders involved in your particular agreement. So how do you make sure that everyone is getting what they want and everyone feels like they're being treated fairly?
Yeah, that's a good question. The first thing I'd say is be at the front end, really understand that no one can make the farmer sign a wind farm agreement. So it's not like the mining scenario where the proponent has certain powers to ultimately force your hand or to bring you to the table or go to the mining warden to get an order, anything like that. It is a threat that could exist in the future. In the eastern states, they have legislation in Victoria where wind farm proponents have greater ability to enter land and do all that. But at this time, farmers have 100% power to just say no. It's important to understand that. And I think there's a lot of pre-signing stuff, like people that sign exclusivity and confidentiality obligations without having proper detailed arrangements as to what's going to apply going forward, really are signing away that bargaining power. And the confidentiality one's important too, because we spoke a lot between and we worked together as sort of other landholders. And because we had no confidentiality obligations generally, we were able to engage with other farmers that were looking at wind farm projects and get a sense of what we were talking about was market or better and what they were doing. And that was really helpful. So I'd be wary for anyone out there, be wary about signing exclusivity or confidentiality obligations before you've got a deal. The second thing I'd say about forming a syndicate, we formed a group of growers, or farmers that are involved in the project that grew as we went along, because the number of growers that came into the project increased. And that was really helpful to have everyone on the same page. And there was a lot of, I don't think there'd be quite a few people you wouldn't get to sign without the confidence that other people had signed. We also agreed amongst ourselves that we would have the same set of terms and conditions, including commercials. And that was enshrined in the documentation so that for the people that signed later couldn't just basically so everyone would end up having the same deal. There wouldn't be suspicions between us. And the reality is that, and this is an important point to make, no one would have signed unless they had that confidence, because they would have held out. They would all want to be the last person to sign. I mean, if you're the last person to sign, you think you can drive the hardest deal. Well, we understand that, but we all want to have a good deal. No one would be willing to sign until they knew they had the best deal, and it would be a chicken and the egg thing. No one would end up signing. So we ultimately had to come to the view that all of the landholders would agree that we would negotiate a common agreement with the same commercials so that people could sign up incrementally as they got their own affairs in order, because there's a fair bit of backroom stuff that needs to be done so that, and it's precipitated some succession discussions and things like that too, because you have to have that lined up in many ways before you can sign the wind farm agreement, because it has such a long time period that it applies. So yeah, I guess the major things I'd say is be wary about exclusivity and confidentiality undertakings that are given prematurely, and form a syndicate if you can and work together. And then that means you can then pool your resources. You can have the best law firm that you can go and get to represent you, which you can bet your bottom dollar they will have. So you need to have that to go toe-to-toe with and to have the expertise, because a smaller firm might have the capacity to do the general commercial. But when you start talking about the electricity market and the formulas that might go into working out what the gross revenue is for the project and things like that, they're all really specific things, and you end up getting tax advice, you end up getting, yes, really quite specialised advice, and a big firm is better able to have that breadth of expertise, because they can go to the experts within their firm to get that advice, and they've got the horsepower to turn around the documentation in a fairly rapid way.
Kelly, any final thoughts from you on the key learnings from the survey and the lit review that you want to make sure our listeners are well aware of?
We've understood that renewable energy isn't going away, and we do see it as a potential income stream for growers when managed well. It can complement the farming business rather than compete with it, and that is really driven by gathering information and understanding what the financial implications could be going forward. So understanding what the economic feasibility is and understanding those specific contracts and confidentiality agreements and the influence of those. Yeah, so going in eyes wide open, trying to collect as much information as you can before making that informed decision.
Thanks for listening to Farmanco's limited series on integrating renewable energy into agriculture. This project is supported by the Southwest WA Drought Resilience Adoption and Innovation Hub through funding from the Australian Government's Future Drought Fund.